Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from Great Short Stories of the Masters, edited by Charles Nieder. An Evening in Spring by Ivan Bunin. On St. Thomas's Week, on a clear evening, barely tinged with rose, at that enchanting time when the earth has just been freed from the snow, when, in the little hollows upon the steps, underneath the young bare oaks, some gray, hardened snow still lingers, an old beggar was going from house to house in a certain village in the Elitz province. Of course he had no hat, and there was a long linen wallet slung over his shoulder. This village was a large one, but quiet, lying far out among the fields, and besides, it happened to be a quiet evening. There was nobody near the flooded clayey pond that one could not see the limits of, nor upon the level common where, in the shade of the huts and hayricks, this old man was walking. His head was bald, yet still black-haired. He held a long walnut staff in his hand and looked like a primitive bishop. The common was of a clear, vivid green. The air was freshening. The pond, concavely full, its tone that of a flashing flesh color, was slightly crimson, and there was a certain beauty about it, despite a bottle-green block of ice covered with rusty manure that still floated about in it. Somewhere on the other side, warmly and caressingly lit up against the low-lying sun, somewhere far off, it seemed, a child, strayed behind some corn kiln or storehouse, was crying, and its plaintive, monotonous wailing was not unpleasant to the ear in the evening glow, but the folk thereabouts were none too generous of alms. There at the entrance to the village, near an old, well-to-do farm, where age-old oaks covered with the nests of rooks stood beyond the three-roomed izba of dark red brick, a young gray-eyed married woman had given something, but even that had been a trifle. She had been standing near the stone threshold, amid the drying spring mire, upon a hard-beaten path, holding a pretty little girl whose little eyes did not show any glimmer of intelligence, perched in her arms. The child had on a little patchwork cap, and pressing her close against her, the woman was dancing, stamping her bare feet, and as she turned, her cotton skirt would swell out. "There's an old man. I'll give you to him to put in his little wallet," she was saying through her teeth, her lips feasting on the little girl's cheeks. "I'm a-goin' to dance, so's the floor will creak." And turning completely around, she changed her voice to a ringing, coquettish tone, evidently imitative of someone. "Old man, old man, don't you need a little girl?" The girl was not a bit frightened. She was calmly sucking around cracknel, and the mother began coaxing the little girl in all sorts of ways to give it to the smiling beggar who had come up. "Give it to him, my little babe, give it to him, for you and I are all alone on this whole farm, so we have nothing to give alms with." And the little girl stolidly stretched out her short little arm, with a saliva-moistened cookie clenched in her little fist. And the beggar, smilingly shaking his head at other folks' happiness, took it and munched it as he went on his way. He held his stick lightly in readiness as he went. Now it would be a wicked, snarling watchdog that would roll up in a ball underneath your feet, and having rolled right up to you, would suddenly become quiet, or else a yellow, downy hound would ferociously tear the ground and throw it up with his hind feet, standing near a hayrick and growling, growling, and gasping with fiery eyes. Upon approaching the little window of a hut, the beggar would make a humble bow and would tap lightly against the frame with his staff. But often no one would respond to this tap. Many were still finishing up their sowing, finishing up their plowing. Many were out in the fields. And his soul, the soul of a peasant from of old, even rejoiced in secret. "The folks are out in the field. This is the time that feeds the whole year. No time for beggars." And at times, on the other side of the panes upon which the beggar tapped, a fair-faced peasant woman carrying a child at breast in her arms would lean over as she sat on a bench. Through the sorry little window she appeared very big, not at all abashed because the beggar could see her soft breast as white as wheat flour. She would wave him away with her large hand, covered with silver rings, while the infant, without letting the sweet nipple out of its mouth, lay back and looked up at her with its dark, clear eyes, scratching hard its bare little outspread legs, all dotted with pink from flea bites. "God will give you alms. Don't be angry with us," the peasant woman would say calmly. As for the old women, each one of them would wrinkle up her face painfully, inevitably leaning out and complaining for a long time, constantly reiterating that she'd be glad as glad could be to give alms, but there wasn't anything. Everybody was out in the fields. And to give without asking, she was afraid. She, being an old woman, had had her head bitten off long ago, as it was. The beggar would agree with her, would say, "Well, forgive me for the love of God," and would go on farther. He had done 30 versts that day and was not a bit fatigued. Only his legs had grown benumbed, dulled, and had begun to wobble. His long bag was half filled with crusts and some odds and ends, while under the patched long coat, narrow belted and long skirted, under the sheepskin jacket and the much worn blouse, under the shirt next to his skin, there had been hanging upon his crucifix an amulet wherein were sewn 92 rubles in bills. And his soul was at rest. Of course he was old, thin, all-weather-beaten, his mouth contracted, parched, until it was all black, his nose was like a bone, his neck all in wrinkles resembling cracks, criss-crossing one another, as though his neck were made of cork. But he was still spry. His eyes, which once upon a time had been black, were now rheumy and dimmed with thin cataracts. But still they could see not only the full-flooded pond, but as well the roseate tint upon its farther side, and even the clear, pale sky. The air was getting fresher, more loudly, but seemingly from a still greater distance, came the receding cry of the child. There was a scent of the chilling grass in the air. Two pigeons soared together over the roofs, fell into the clayey little bank of the pond, and, raising their little heads, began to drink. Just a little before, in a lonely farm near the great road, some women had grown generous and had given him a big piece of calico and a pair of good trousers. Oh, good as new, you might say. A young fellow that belonged to their farm had made them for himself, but he had been crushed in a pit in the quarry where the mujiks had been digging for clay. Now the beggar was walking along and deliberating. Should he dispose of them or put them on himself and throw away those he had on, which by now were really none too presentable, near the edge of some field? Having come to the end of the village, he entered a short little lane that led out into the steppe, and into his eyes glanced the many-rayed, fair-weather sun of April, sinking far beyond the plain, beyond the gray fallow lands and the newly-tilled fields of spring corn. At the very end of the village, at a turn of the well-beaten, glistening road, leading to that distant, humble hamlet where the beggar was thinking of passing the night, stood a new hut, not large, well-roofed with a new thatch, which was lemon-colored and resembled a well-combed head. Keeping aloof from everybody, a man and his wife had settled here a year ago. There were shavings and chips still knocking about, here and there. They were a thrifty, hard-working, agreeable couple, and sold vodka on the sly. And so the beggar went straight toward his hut. There was a possibility of selling the new trousers to its owner, and besides, he liked just to enter it. He liked it because it seemed to be living some especial life, all its own, quiet and steadfast, standing at the end leading out of the village and gazing with its clear little windows upon the setting of the sun, while the skylarks were finishing their song in the chilling air. Near the blind wall that gave out upon the by-lane lay a shadow, but its front wall was gay. Last fall, its owner had planted three acacia bushes beneath the little windows. Now they had taken root and were already downy with a yellowish verdure tender as that of a willow. Having skirted them, the beggar walked in through the entry into the main room. At first, after the sunlight, he could not see anything, although the sun was looking in here as well, lighting up the blue transparent smoke floating over the table that stood underneath a hanging tin lamp. To gain time, while his eyes grew accustomed, he bowed and crossed himself for a long time in the direction of the newly tinseled icon hanging in a corner. Then he laid down his bag and his staff on the floor near the door and made out a large-body mujik in bast shoes and a tattered short sheepskin coat, sitting with his back to the door on a stool near the table, the well-dressed mistress he saw sitting on a bench. "The Lord's blessing be with you," he said, in a low voice, bowing once more. "Greetings of the holiday just past." He wanted to sing the paschal Christ is risen, but felt that it would be out of place, and reflected. Well, I guess the master is not at home. What a pity. The mistress was not at all bad-looking, with a very shapely waist, with white hands, just as though she were no mere peasant woman. She was in a gala dress, as always, in a pearl necklace, in a blouse of coarse calico, with thin puffed-out sleeves, with an apron broidered in red and blue, in a skirt of indigo wool with terracotta checks, and in half-boots, rough but well-sewn and made to fit the foot, their heels shod with steel. With her neat hand and clear face bent down, she was embroidering a blouse for her husband. When the beggar had greeted her, she raised her steady but unglittering eyes, threw an intent glance upon him, and nodded amiably. Then, with a light sigh, she laid her work aside, deftly stuck her needle in it, went toward the oven, her half-boots clacking over the wooden floor and her flanks swaying, and took a small bottle of vodka and a thick cup with blue stripes out of a little cupboard. "I've gotten tired, though," said the beggar, as if he was talking to himself, both an apology for the vodka and because he was confused by the silence of the moujik, who had not turned around toward him. Stepping softly in his bass shoes, humbly walking around him, the beggar sat down upon another stool at an opposite corner of the table. As for the mistress, she put the cup and the small bottle before him and went back to her work. Then the stalwart, tattered son of the steps raised his head heavily. There was a whole greenish demijohn standing before him, and narrowing his eyes, he fixed his gaze upon his humble bottle companion. He may have been pretending just a trifle, but still, his face was inflamed, his eyes were drunken, filled with the dull glitter of tipsiness. The lips, grown soft and flabby, were half open, as in a fever. Evidently, this was not the first day of his spree. And the beggar grew a little more wary, and carefully began filling his cup. "After all, now he'll drink his, and I'll drink mine. This is a tavern, and we don't bother one another," he was thinking. He raised his head, and his mistily black eyes, the color of ripe slow-thorn, as well as his whole visage, made rough and weather-beaten by the step, were void of all expression. "Where was you tramping?" asked the moujik, roughly and crazily. "Have you come to steal, seeing as how all the folks are out in the fields?" "Why should I be stealing?" the beggar replied, evenly and meekly. "I've had 6 children of my own and my own house and goods." "You're blind and you're blind, but never fear, many's the feather and the twig you've carried to your nest." "Why should you be saying that? I've worked hard as could be for 10 years in the quartz mines." "That ain't work, that's—" "Don't you be saying anything out of the way," said the mistress without elevating her voice, without raising her lashes, and bit off the thread. "I don't listen to anything unseemly. I ain't heard it from my husband yet." "Well, that will do. I won't do it any more." "Lady," said the moujik, "'scuse me. I'm after asking you," said he to the beggar frowningly, "what can you get out of the ground now when it ain't been ploughed nor sown?" "Well, now, of course, whoever has the land, for example—" "Wait, I'm smarter than you be," said the moujik, slapping the table with his palm. "Answer what you're asked. Did you serve for a soldier?" "I was a non-commissioned officer of the 10th Grenadiers Regiment of Little Russia, under Count Rumenotsov Zadunaisky. What else should I be doing but serving for a soldier?" "Keep still, don't gabble more'n you're asked. What year was you took?" "In 76, in the month of November." "Wasn't you ever at fault?" "Never." "Did you obey the officers?" "There was no way of my doing otherwise. I had taken an oath." "But what's that scar doing on your neck? Do you understand what I'm driving at now?" "I am testing him," said the moujik, with his eyebrows working surlily, but changing his commanding voice for a more simple one, and turning toward the mistress his crazed face, aureately illumined through the tobacco smoke by the sunset. "I may be poor, all right, but I've caught more than one fellow like that. I know enough to come in out of the rain." And again he put on a frown, looking at the beggar. "Did you bow down before the Holy Cross and the Gospel?" "That I have," answered the beggar, who had managed to take a drink, to wipe his mouth with his sleeve, to sit up straight again, and to impart to his face and his misty eyes a dispassionate expression. The moujik surveyed him with glazed eyes. "Stand up before me." "Don't raise any fuss. Am I talking to you, or am I not?" the mistress quietly intervened. "Wait, for the love of God," the moujik waved her away in vexation. "Stand up before me." "Honest to God, what are you up to?" the beggar began to mumble. "Stand up, I'm telling you," yelled the moujik. "I'm a-going to examine you." The beggar stood up and shifted from foot to foot. Hands at the sides. So, got a passport? But are you an inspector or something? Keep still. Don't you dare to jaw back at me like that. I'm smarter than you be. I went all through this myself. Show it to me this minute. Hastily unhooking his long overcoat, then his sheepskin jacket, the beggar submissively rummaged within the bosom of his shirt for a long time. Finally, he pulled out a paper wrapped up in a red handkerchief. Give it here, said the mujik abruptly. And unwrapping the little handkerchief, the beggar handed him a small, frayed gray book with a large wax seal. The mujik awkwardly opened it with his gnarled fingers and pretended to read it, putting it at a distance from him, leaning back and looking at it for a long time through the tobacco smoke and the red light of the evening glow. So, I see now. Everything ship-shape. Take it back, he said, his parched lips moving with difficulty. I'm as poor can be. It's the second spring, you might say, that I'm neither ploughing nor sowing. Folks have done it for me. I fell down at his feet, the dog that he is, and yet I'm beyond a price, you might say. But you just tell me all that you've stolen, or else I'll kill you right off, he yelled ferociously. I know everything. I've gone through all sorts of things. I've been boiled in pitch, you might say. That's how I've suffered. It is the Lord that gives us life, but any vermin can take it away. Give the bag here, and that's all there is to it. The mistress merely shook her head and leaned back from her embroidery, contemplating it. The beggar went toward the door and gave the mujik the bag, just as he had given him the passport. The mujik took it, and as he laid it near him on the stool, he said, That's right. Now sit down. Let's chat a bit. I'll get to the bottom of all this here. I'll make an inspection of my own. Don't you fret. And he became silent, staring at the table. Spring, he muttered. Ah, but what a sorrowful Sabbath day it is, that a man may not work in the fields. Go on, he cried out to some imagined person trying to snap his fingers. Oh, the lady starts to dance, and her fingers is all blue. And he relapsed into silence. The mistress was smoothing down the embroidery with her thimble. I'm going out to milk the cow, said she, getting up from her seat. Don't blow up the fire whilst I'm out, or else you'll burn us out in your drunkenness. The mujik came, too, with a start. Lordy, he exclaimed in hurt tones. Little mistress, how can you say that? You've grown aweary for your husband, never fear. That's none of your worry, said the mistress. He's in town on business. He don't go traipsing around no inns. You'd go traipsing, too, said the mujik. Well, what would you have me do now? Go out on the wayside or what? You rich devils are all right. The mistress, picking up a milk pail, went out. It was growing dark in the hut. Everything was quiet, and the roseate light was suffused in the soft spring obscurity. The mujik, with his elbows on the table, was dozing as he pulled at an extinguished, crudely made cigarette. The beggar was sitting peacefully, with never a sound, leaning against the dark partition, and his face was almost invisible. "Do you drink beer?" asked the mujik. "I do," came the low answer out of the dusk. The mujik was silent for a while. "We are vagabonds, you and me," said he, morosely and meditatively. "Poor wayside rubbish. Beggarmen, I feel weary in your company." "That's right. But as for beer, I like it," said the mujik loudly after another silence. She won't keep it, the carrion. Otherwise I would have drunk some beer and would have had a snack of something. My tongue's all soaked. I want to eat. I would have had a snack and drunk something. Yes, but she, the mistress, ain't got such a bad face. If I was harnessed up with one like her, I would. All right, never mind. Sit down, sit down. I got respect for the blind. Whenever a grand holiday used to come around, I would take 20 of these here blind men now and seat them at a table. You would have had to look and look to find another household like ours. And they would sing a stave to me and make me a bow to boot. Do you know how to sing staves? About Alexei, the man of God? I do take to that stave. Pick up your cup. I'll treat you to some of mine. Having taken the cup from the beggar's hands, he held it up to the faint light of the evening glow and half-filled it. The beggar got up, made a low bow, drained the cup to the bottom, and again sat down. The mujik dragged the beggar's bag upon his knees and, untying it, began to mutter, "I sized you up at once. I've got enough money of my own, brother. You're no mate for me. I go through my money in cold blood. I drink it away. I drink away a horse a year and set a good ram up in smoke. Aha, so you've run up against a bit of a moujik. Do you understand who I am? But still, I feel sorry for you. I understand. There's thousands of the likes of you roaming about in springtime. There's mire and sloughs and never a path or a road, but you've got to keep on going, bowing before everybody, and you can never tell whether they'll give you anything or no. Eh, brother, don't I understand you? Asked the moujik with bitter sorrow and his eyes filled with tears. No, this time of the year is not so bad. It's all right, said the beggar quietly. You walk along a field, over a big abandoned tract that had once been planned for a road, all alone with never another soul nigh. Then, too, there's a dear sun and the warm weather. True, there's many a thousand of the likes of me roaming about. Half of Russia is roaming so. I've drunk away 2 horses, said the moujik, raking the crusts out of the bag, pulling out a waistcoat, the calico, the trousers, and a bass shoe. I'm going to go all through your miserable pickings and old rags. Hold on, pants. I must buy them from you, soon as I come into a little money. How much? The beggar thought for a while. Why, I'd let them go for 2. I'll give you 3, said the moujik, getting up, placing the trousers under him and sitting down upon them. They're mine. But where's the other shoe? It will pass for new. That means you must have stolen it for sure. But then it's better to be thieving than to be grieving your heart out in the springtime, the way I'm a-doing now. To be perishing from hunger, to be coming to the end of your rope, when you take the very least of the shepherds, and you'll find him at work. I have drunk a horse away, but a beastie like that is worth more nor any man. But am I no ploughman, no reaper? And now you sing a stave, or I'll kill you right off, he cried out. I feel weary in your company. In a quavering, modest, but practiced voice, the beggar began to sing out of the obscurity. Once upon a time there lived and were 2 brethren. 2 blood brethren, 2 brethren in God and Christ. Eh, 2 brethren in God and Christ, the moujik chimed in a high-pitched and piteous tone, straining his voice. The beggar, with even churchly chanting, continued. One dwelt in cold and poverty, rotting in his leprosy. And the other was rich. Out of tune, drowning out the beggar with tears in his voice, the moujik caught up the song. Put more heart in it, he cried out as his voice broke. Grief has swallowed me up. All men are having a holiday. All men are sowing. But here I be, biting the earth. It's the 2nd spring that my mother earth has been barren. Let me have your cup, or I'll kill you right off. Open the window for me. And again the beggar submissively gave him his cup. Then he started to open the window. Being new, it had swollen and would not yield for a long while. Finally it did yield and flew open. A fresh, pleasant odor of the fields floated in. It was completely dark out there now. The roseate night glow had become extinguished, barely shimmering over the soft darkness of the quiet, joyous, fecundated field. One could hear the half-drowsy skylarks finishing their very last songs. Sing, Lazarus, sing, my own brother, said the moujik, extending a full cup to the beggar. We're 2 of a kind, you and me. Only what are you alongside of me? A vagabond, whereas I am a working man that gives food and drink to all those that suffer. He sat down suddenly, losing his balance, and again dug into the bag. And what might you have here? He asked, examining the calico, which had turned the faintest pink in the barely perceptible light of the evening glow. Oh, that's just so. Some women gave it to me, said the beggar quietly, feeling everything floating before him from tipsiness, and that it was time to be going, and that it was necessary to extricate the trousers from underneath the moujik somehow. How can that be? You lie, cried out the moujik, banging the table with his fist. It's a shroud, I can see. It's a grave shroud, he cried out with tears in his voice, and was silent for a while, hearkening to the abating songs of the skylarks. Then he shoved the bag away from him, and shaking his tousled head, began to cry. I have risen in my pride against God, said he bitterly, weeping. And then straining himself, he began to sing loudly, keeping good time. Oh, my mother gave me birth, and she guarded me. Though I now a sinner be, unforgivable. All the torments have I borne, all the sorrows have I borne. Nowhere's found I joy for me. Oh, my mother spoke to me, and she cautioned me. If she only knew, if she only saw, she could never bear such calamity. Oh, my soul is a sinner and is a creeping thing, he cried out wildly, weeping, and suddenly started clapping his palms with an eldritch laughter. Beggarman, give me your money. I know you through and through. I feel you through and through. Give it to me. I know you have it. It can't be otherwise. Give it to me for the love of the Lord God himself. And swaying, he arose, and the beggar, who had also arisen, felt his legs giving away from fear, felt a dull ache start in his thighs. The tear-stained face of the mujik, barely discernible in the twilight, was insane. Give it to me, he repeated, in a voice suddenly grown hoarse. Give it to me for the love of the Queen of Heaven. I can see, you're grabbing at your bosom, at your undershirt. That means you've got it. All your kind has. Give it to me. It ain't of no use to you anyway, whereas it will set me on my feet forever. Give it to me of your own will. Brother, don't lead me into sin. Can't do it, said the beggar quietly and dispassionately. What? Can't do it. I've been saving for 20 years. Can't bring myself to do it. You ain't going to give it to me? Asked the mujik hoarsely. No, said the beggar, barely audible but unshaken. The mujik was silent for a long while. The beating of their hearts could be heard in the darkness. Very well, said the mujik, with an insane submissiveness. I will kill you. I'll go and find me a stone and then kill you. And swaying, he went toward the threshold. The beggar, standing erect in the darkness, made a sweeping and slow sign of the cross. As for the mujik, he, with his head lowered like a bull, was already walking about under the windows. Then there came a crunching sound. Evidently he was pulling a stone out of the foundation. And a minute later the door slammed again, and the beggar drew himself up still more. For the last time, I'm a-tellin' you, the mujik mumbled out with his cracked lips, walking up to him with a big white stone in his hands. Brother! The beggar was silent. His face could not be seen. Swinging back with his left arm and catching the beggar by his neck, the mujik struck hard his shrinking face with the chill stone. The beggar tore away backward, and as he fell, catching the table with his bashed shoe, he struck the back of his head against a stool and then against the floor. And falling upon him, the mujik, squeezing the breath out of his chest, frenziedly began to batter in his throat with the stone. 10 minutes later, he was already far out in the dark, even field. There were many stars out. The air was fresh. The earth gave forth a metallic odor. Completely sobered up, he was walking so rapidly and lightly that he seemed capable of covering 100 versts more. The amulet, torn off the beggar's crucifix, he was holding tightly clenched in his hand. Later, he flung it from him into a dark, freshly plowed field. His eyes were staring fixedly like an owl's. His teeth were tightly clenched like a lobster's claws. Although he had looked for his cap for a long while, he'd been unable to find it in the darkness. The chillness beamed upon his bared head. His head seemed to him to be of stone. And that was An Evening in Spring by Ivan Bunin, from Great Short Stories of the Masters, edited by Charles Nieder. You're listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from the same book, A Passion in the Desert by Honoré de Balzac. The whole show is dreadful, she cried, coming out of the menagerie of Monsieur Martin. She had just been looking at that daring spectacular working with his hyena, to speak in the style of the program. By what means, she continued, can he have tamed these animals to such a point as to be certain of their affection for? What seems to you a problem, said I, interrupting, is really quite natural. Oh, she cried, letting an incredulous smile wander over her lips. You think that beasts are wholly without passions? I asked her. Quite the reverse. We can communicate to them all the vices arising in our own state of civilization. She looked at me with an air of astonishment. Nevertheless, I continued, the first time I saw Monsieur Martin, I admit, like you, I did give vent to an exclamation of surprise. I found myself next to an old soldier with the right leg amputated who had come in with me. His face had struck me. He had one of those intrepid heads stamped with the seal of warfare and on which the battles of Napoleon are written. Besides, he had that frank, good-humored expression which always impresses me favorably. He was without a doubt one of those troopers who are surprised at nothing, who find matter for laughter in the contortions of a dying comrade, who bury or plunder him quite light-heartedly, who stand intrepidly in the way of bullets, in fact one of those men who waste no time in deliberation, and would not hesitate to make friends with the devil himself. After looking very attentively at the proprietor of the menagerie getting out of his box, my companion pursed up his lips with an air of mockery and contempt, with that peculiar and expressive twist which superior people assume to show they are not taken in. Then, when I was expatiating on the courage of Monsieur Martin, he smiled, shook his head knowingly, and said, "Well known." "How well known?" I said. "If you would only explain to me the mystery, I should be vastly obliged." After a few minutes, during which we made acquaintance, we went to dine at the first restaurateur's whose shop caught our eye. At dessert, a bottle of champagne completely refreshed and brightened up the memories of this odd old soldier. He told me his story, and I said he had every reason to explain, "well known." When she got home, she teased me to that extent and made so many promises that I consented to communicate to her the old soldier's confidences. Next day she received the following episode of an epic which one might call The Frenchman in Egypt. During the expedition in Upper Egypt under General Desay, a Provençal soldier fell into the hands of the Maghrebins and was taken by these Arabs into the deserts beyond the falls of the Nile. In order to place a sufficient distance between themselves and the French army, the Maghrebins made forced marches and only rested during the night. They camped round a well overshadowed by palm trees under which they had previously concealed a store of provisions. Not surmising that the notion of flight would occur to their prisoner, they contented themselves with binding his hands, and after eating a few dates and giving provender to their horses, went to sleep. When the brave Provençal saw that his enemies were no longer watching him, he made use of his teeth to steal a scimitar, fixed the blade between his knees, and cut the cords which prevented using his hands. In a moment he was free. He at once seized a rifle and dagger, then taking the precaution to provide himself with a sack of dried dates, oats, and powder, and shot, and to fasten a scimitar to his waist, he leaped onto a horse and spurred on vigorously in the direction where he thought to find the French army. So impatient was he to see a bivouac again that he pressed on the already tired courser at such speed that its flanks were lacerated with his spurs, and at last the poor animal died, leaving the Frenchman alone in the desert. After walking some time in the sand with all the courage of an escaped convict, the soldier was obliged to stop as the day had already ended. In spite of the beauty of an oriental sky at night, he felt he had not strength enough to go on. Fortunately, he had been able to find a small hill, on the summit of which a few palm trees shot up into the air. It was their verdure, the scene from afar, which had brought hope and consolation to his heart. His fatigue was so great that he lay down upon a rock of granite, capriciously cut out like a camp bed. There he fell asleep without taking any precautions to defend himself while he slept. He had made the sacrifice of his life. His last thought was one of regret. He repented having left the Maghrebins, whose nomad life seemed to smile on him now that he was afar from them and without help. He was awakened by the sun, whose pitiless rays fell with all their force on the granite and produced an intolerable heat, for he had had the stupidity to place himself inversely to the shadow thrown by the verdant majestic heads of the palm trees. He looked at the solitary trees and shuddered. They reminded him of the graceful shafts crowned with foliage which characterized the Saracen columns in the Cathedral of Arras. But when, after counting the palm trees, he cast his eye around him, the most horrible despair was infused into his soul. Before him stretched an ocean without limit. The dark sand of the desert spread farther than sight could reach in every direction, and glittered like steel struck with a bright light. It might have been a sea of looking-glass or lakes melted together in a mirror. A fiery vapor carried up in streaks made a perpetual whirlwind over the quivering land. The sky was lit with an oriental splendor of insupportable purity, leaving naught for the imagination to desire. Heaven and earth were on fire. The silence was awful in its wild and terrible majesty. Infinity, immensity, closed in upon the soul from every side. Not a cloud in the sky, not a breath in the air, not a flaw in the bosom of the sand. Ever moving in diminutive waves, the horizon ended as a sea on a clear day, with one line of light, definite as the cut of a sword. The Provençal threw his arms around the trunk of one of the palm trees, as though it were the body of a friend, And then in the shelter of the thin, straight shadow that the palm cast upon the granite, he wept. Then sitting down, he remained as he was, contemplating with profound sadness the implacable scene, which was all he had to look upon. He cried aloud to measure the solitude. His voice, lost in the hollows of the hill, sounded faintly and aroused no echo. The echo was in his own heart. The Provençal was 22 years old. He loaded his carbine. "There'll be time enough," he said to himself, laying on the ground the weapon which alone could bring him deliverance. Looking by turns at the black expanse and the blue expanse, the soldier dreamed of France. He smelt with delight the gutters of Paris. He remembered the towns through which he had passed, the faces of his fellow soldiers, the most minute details of his life. His southern fancy soon showed him the stones of his beloved Provence in the play of the heat which waved over the spreadsheet of the desert. Fearing the danger of this cruel mirage, he went down the opposite side of the hill to that by which he had come up the day before. The remains of a rug showed that this place of refuge had at one time been inhabited. At a short distance he saw some palm trees full of dates. Then the instinct which binds us to life awoke again in his heart. He hoped to live long enough to await the passing of some Arabs, or perhaps he might hear the sound of cannon, for at this time Bonaparte was traversing Egypt. This thought gave him new life. The palm trees seemed to bend with the weight of the ripe fruit. He shook some of it down. When he tasted this unhoped-for manna, he felt sure that the palms had been cultivated by a former inhabitant. The savory fresh meat of the dates was proof of the care of his predecessor. He passed suddenly from dark despair into an almost insane joy. He went up again to the top of the hill and spent the rest of the day in cutting down one of the sterile palm trees, which the night before had served him for shelter. A vague memory made him think of the animals of the desert, and in case they might come to drink at the spring, visible from the base of the rocks but lost farther down, he resolved to guard himself from their visits by placing a barrier at the entrance of his hermitage. In spite of his diligence and the strength which the fear of being devoured asleep gave him, he was unable to cut the palms in pieces, though he succeeded in cutting it down. At eventide the king of the desert fell. The sound of its fall resounded far and wide like a sign in the solitude. The soldiers shuddered as though he had heard some voice predicting woe. But like an heir who does not long bewail a deceased parent, he tore off from this beautiful tree the tall, broad green leaves, which are its poetic adornment, and used them to mend the mat on which he was to sleep. Fatigued by the heat and his work, he fell asleep under the red curtains of his wet cave. In the middle of the night his sleep was troubled by an extraordinary noise. He sat up, and the deep silence around him allowed him to distinguish the alternative accents of a respiration whose savage energy could not belong to a human creature. A profound terror, increased still further by the darkness, the silence, and his waking images, froze his heart within him. He almost felt his hair stand on end, when by straining his eyes to their utmost he perceived through the shadows two faint yellow lights. At first he attributed these lights to the reflection of his own pupils, but soon the vivid brilliance of the night aided him gradually to distinguish the objects around him in the cave, and he beheld a huge animal lying but two steps from him. Was it a lion, a tiger, or a crocodile? The Provençal was not educated enough to know under what species his enemy ought to be classed, but his fright was all the greater as his ignorance led him to imagine all terrors at once. He endured a cruel torture, noting every variation of the breathing close to him without daring to make the slightest movement. An odor, pungent like that of a fox, but more penetrating, profounder, so to speak, filled the cave, and when the Provençal became sensible of this, his terror reached its height, for he could no longer doubt the proximity of a terrible companion whose royal dwelling served him for shelter. Presently the reflection of the moon, descending upon the horizon, lit up the den, rendering gradually visible and resplendent the spotted skin of a panther. The lion of Egypt slept, curled up like a big dog, the peaceful possessor of a sumptuous niche at the gate of a hotel. Its eyes opened for a moment and closed again. Its face was turned toward the man. A thousand confused thoughts passed through the Frenchman's mind. First he thought of killing it with a bullet from his gun, but he saw there was not enough distance between them for him to take proper aim. The shot would miss the mark. And if it were to wake! The thought made his limbs rigid. He listened to his own heart beating in the midst of the silence and cursed the two violent pulsations which the flow of blood brought on, fearing to disturb that sleep which allowed him time to think of some means of escape. Twice he placed his hand on his scimitar, intending to cut off the head of the enemy, but the difficulty of cutting the stiff, short hair compelled him to abandon this daring project. To miss would be to die for certain, he thought. He preferred the chances of fair fight and made up his mind to wait until morning. The morning did not leave him long to wait. He could now examine the panther at ease. Its muzzle was smeared with blood. She's had a good dinner, he thought, without troubling himself as to whether her feast might have been on human flesh. She won't be hungry when she gets up. It was a female. The fur on her belly and flanks was glistening white. Many small marks, like velvet, formed beautiful bracelets round her feet. Her sinuous tail was also white, ending with black rings. The over part of her dress, yellow like unburnished gold, very lissome and soft, had the characteristic blotches in the form of rosettes, which distinguished the panther from every other feline species. This tranquil and formidable hostess snored in an attitude as graceful as that of a cat lying on a cushion. Her blood-stained paws, nervous and well-armed, were stretched out before her face, which rested upon them, and from which radiated her straight, slender whiskers like threads of silver. If she had been like that in a cage, the Provençal would doubtless have admired the grace of the animal, and the vigorous contrast of vivid color which gave her robe an imperial splendor, but just then his sight was troubled by her sinister appearance. The presence of the panther, even asleep, could not fail to produce the effect which the magnetic eyes of the serpent are said to have on the nightingale. For a moment the courage of the soldier began to fail before this danger, though no doubt it would have risen at the mouth of a cannon charged with shell. Nevertheless, a bold thought brought daylight to his soul and sealed up the source of the cold sweat which sprang forth on his brow. Like men driven to bay who defy death and offer their body to the smiter, so he, seeing in this merely a tragic episode, resolved to play his part with honor to the last. The day before yesterday the Arabs would have killed me, perhaps, he said, so considering himself as good as dead already, he waited bravely, with excited curiosity, his enemy's awakening. When the sun appeared, the panther suddenly opened her eyes. Then she put out her paws with energy as if to stretch them and get rid of cramp. At last she yawned, showing the formidable apparatus of her teeth and pointed tongue, rough as a file. A regular petite maîtresse, thought the Frenchman, seeing her roll herself about so softly and coquettishly. She licked off the blood which stained her paws and muzzle, and scratched her head with reiterated gestures full of prettiness. All right, make a little toilet, the Frenchman said to himself, beginning to recover his gaiety with his courage. We'll say good morning to each other presently, and he seized a small short dagger which he had taken from the Maghrebins. At this moment the panther turned her head toward the man and looked at him fixedly without moving. The rigidity of her metallic eyes and their insupportable luster made him shudder, especially when the animal walked toward him. But he looked at her caressingly, staring into her eyes in order to magnetize her, and let her come quite close to him. Then, with a movement both gentle and amorous, as though he were caressing the most beautiful of women, he passed his hand over her whole body, from the head to the tail, scratching the flexible vertebrae which divided the panther's yellow back. The animal waved her tail voluptuously, and her eyes grew gentle, and when for the third time the Frenchman accomplished this interesting flattery, she gave forth one of those purrings by which our cats express their pleasure, but this murmur issued from the throat so powerful and so deep that it resounded through the cave like the last vibrations of an organ in a church. The man, understanding the importance of his caresses, redoubled them in such a way as to surprise and stupefy his imperious courtesan. When he felt sure of having extinguished the ferocity of his capricious companion, whose hunger had so fortunately been satisfied the day before, he got up to go out of the cave. The panther let him go out, but when he had reached the summit of the hill, she sprang with the lightness of a sparrow hopping from twig to twig, and rubbed herself against his legs, putting up her back after a manner of all the race of cats. Then, regarding her guest with eyes whose glare had softened a little, she gave vent to that wild cry which naturalists compare to the grating of a saw. "She is exacting," said the Frenchman smilingly. He was bold enough to play with her ears. He caressed her belly and scratched her head as hard as he could. When he saw that he was successful, he tickled her skull with the point of his dagger, watching for the right moment to kill her. but the hardness of her bones made him tremble for his success. The Sultana of the desert showed herself gracious to her slave. She lifted her head, stretched out her neck, and manifested her delight by the tranquility of her attitude. It suddenly occurred to the soldier that to kill this savage princess with one blow he must poignard her in the throat. He raised the blade when the panther, satisfied no doubt, laid herself gracefully at his feet and cast up at him glances in which, in spite of their natural fierceness, was mingled confusedly a kind of good will. The poor Provençal ate his dates, leaning against one of the palm trees, and casting his eyes alternately on the desert in quest of some liberator, and on his terrible companion to watch her uncertain clemency. The panther looked at the place where the date stones fell, and every time that he threw one down, her eyes expressed an incredible mistrust. She examined the man with an almost commercial prudence. However, this examination was favorable to him, for when he had finished his meager meal, she licked his boots with her powerful rough tongue, brushing off with marvelous skill the dust gathered in the creases. "Ah, but when she's really hungry," thought the Frenchman. In spite of the shudder this thought caused him, the soldier began to measure curiously the proportions of the panther, certainly one of the most splendid specimens of its race. She was 3 feet high and 4 feet long, without counting her tail. This powerful weapon, rounded like a cudgel, was nearly 3 feet long. The head, large as that of a lioness, was distinguished by a rare expression of refinement. The cold cruelty of a tiger was dominant, it was true, but there was also a vague resemblance to the face of a sensual woman. Indeed, the face of the solitary queen had something of the gaiety of a drunken Nero. She had satiated herself with blood, and she wanted to play. The soldier tried if he might walk up and down, and the panther left him free, contenting himself with following him with her eyes, less like a faithful dog than a big Angora cat, observing everything and every movement of her master. When he looked around, he saw, by the spring, the remains of his horse. The panther had dragged the carcass all that way. About 2/3 of it had been devoured already. The sight reassured him. It was easy to explain the panther's absence and the respect she had had for him while he slept. The first piece of good luck emboldened him to tempt the future, and he conceived the wild hope of continuing on good terms with the panther during the entire day, neglecting no means of taming her and remaining in her good graces. He returned to her and had the unspeakable joy of seeing her wag her tail with an almost imperceptible movement at his approach. He sat down then, without fear, by her side, and they began to play together. He took her paws and muzzle, pulled her ears, rolled her over on her back, stroked her warm, delicate flanks. She let him do whatever he liked, and when he began to stroke the hair on her feet, she drew her claws in carefully. The man, keeping the dagger in one hand, thought to plunge it into the belly of the too confiding panther, but he was afraid that he would be immediately strangled in her last conclusive struggle. Besides, he felt in his heart a sort of remorse which bid him respect a creature that had done him no harm. He seemed to have found a friend in a boundless desert. Half unconsciously he thought of his first sweetheart, whom he had nicknamed Mignon, by way of contrast, because she was so atrociously jealous that all the time of their love he was in fear of the knife with which she always threatened him. This memory of his early days suggested to him the idea of making the young panther answer to this name, now that he began to admire the less terror her swiftness, suppleness, and softness. Toward the end of the day he had familiarized himself with his perilous position. He now almost liked the painfulness of it. At last his companion had got into the habit of looking up at him whenever he cried in a falsetto voice, "Mignon!" At the setting of the sun, Mignon gave, several times running, a profound melancholy cry. "She's been well brought up," said the light-hearted soldier. "She says her prayers." But this mental joke only occurred to him when he noticed what a pacific attitude his companion remained in. "Come, ma petite blonde, I'll let you go to bed first," he said to her, counting on the activity of his own legs to run away as quickly as possible, directly she was asleep, and seek another shelter for the night. The soldier waited with impatience the hour of his flight, and when it arrived he walked vigorously in the direction of the Nile. But hardly had he made a quarter of a league in the sand when he heard the panther bounding after him, crying with that saw-like cry more dreadful even than the sound of her leaping. "Ah," he said, "then she's taken quite a fancy to me. She has never met anyone before, and it is really quite flattering to have her first love." That instant the man fell into one of those movable quicksands so terrible to travelers and from which it's impossible to save oneself. Feeling himself caught, he gave a shriek of alarm. The panther seized him with her teeth by the collar, and, springing vigorously backward, drew him as if by magic out of the whirling sand. "Ah, mignon," cried the soldier, caressing her enthusiastically. "We're bound together for life and death, but no jokes, mind," and he retraced his steps. From that time the desert seemed inhabited. It contained a being to whom the man could talk and whose ferocity was rendered gentle by him, though he could not explain to himself the reason for their strange friendship. Great as was the soldier's desire to stay upon guard, he slept. On awakening, he could not find Mignon. He mounted the hill and in the distance saw her springing toward him after the habit of these animals, who cannot run on account of the extreme flexibility of the vertebral column. Mignon arrived, her jaws covered with blood. She received the wonted caress of her companion, showing with much purring how happy it made her. Her eyes, full of languor, turned still more gently than the day before toward the Provençal, who talked to her as one would to a tame animal. "Ah, mademoiselle, you are a nice girl, aren't you? Just look at that. So we like to be made much of, don't we? Aren't you ashamed of yourself? So you have been eating some Arab or other, have you? That doesn't matter. They're animals just the same as you are, but don't you take to eating Frenchmen, or I shan't like you any longer." She played like a dog with its master, letting herself be rolled over, knocked about, and stroked alternately. Sometimes she herself would provoke the soldier, putting up her paw with a soliciting gesture. Some days passed in this manner. This companionship permitted the Provençal to appreciate the sublime beauty of the desert. Now that he had a living thing to think about, alternations of fear and quiet and plenty to eat, his mind became filled with contrast and his life began to be diversified. Solitude revealed to him all her secrets and enveloped him in her delights. He discovered in the rising and setting of the sun sights unknown to the world. He knew what it was to tremble when he'd heard over his head the hiss of a bird's wings, so rarely did they pass, or when he saw the clouds changing and many-colored travelers melt one into another. He studied in the nighttime the effect of the moon upon the ocean of sand, where the simoom made waves swift of movement and rapid in their change. He lived the life of the eastern day, marveling at its wonderful pomp. Then, after having reveled in the sight of a hurricane over the plain where the whirling sands made red, dry mists and death-bearing clouds, he would welcome the night with joy, for then fell the healthful freshness of the stars, and he listened to imaginary music in the skies. Then solitude taught him to unroll the treasures of dreams. He passed whole hours in remembering mere nothings and comparing his present life with his past. At last he grew passionately fond of the panther, for some sort of affection was a necessity. Whether it was that his will powerfully projected had modified the character of his companion, or whether because she found abundant food in her predatory excursions in the desert, she respected the man's life. He began to fear for it no longer, seeing her so well tamed. He devoted the greater part of his time to sleep, but he was obliged to watch like a spider in its web that the moment of his deliverance might not escape him, if anyone should pass the line marked by the horizon. He had sacrificed his shirt to make a flag with, which he hung at the top of a palm tree, whose foliage he had torn off. Taught by necessity, he found the means of keeping it spread out, by fastening it with little sticks, for the wind might not be blowing at the moment when the passing traveler was looking through the desert. It was during the long hours when he had abandoned hope that he amused himself with the panther. He had come to learn the different inflections of her voice, the expressions of her eyes. He had studied the capricious patterns of all the rosettes which marked the gold of her robe. Mignon was not even angry when he took hold of the tuft at the end of her tail to count her rings, those graceful ornaments which glittered in the sun like jewelry. It gave him pleasure to contemplate the supple, fine outlines of her form, the whiteness of her belly, the graceful pose of her head. But it was especially when she was playing that he felt most pleasure in looking at her. The agility and youthful lightness of her movements were a continual surprise to him. He wondered at the supple way in which she jumped and climbed, washed herself and arranged her fur, crouched down and prepared to spring. However rapid her spring might be, however slippery the stone she was on, she would always stop short at the word mignon. One day, in the bright midday sun, an enormous bird coursed through the air. The man left his panther to look at this new guest, but after waiting a moment, the deserted sultana growled deeply. "My goodness, I do believe she's jealous," he cried, seeing her eyes become hard again. "The soul of Virginie has passed into her body. That's certain." The eagle disappeared into the air while the soldier admired the curved contour of the panther. But there was such youth and grace in her form. She was beautiful as a woman. The blonde fur of her robe mingled well with the delicate tints of faint white which marked her flanks. The profuse light cast down by the sun made this living gold, these russet markings, to burn in a way to give them indefinable attraction. The man and the panther looked at one another with a look full of meaning. The coquette quivered when she felt her friend stroke her head. Her eyes flashed like lightning, then she shut them tightly. "She has a soul," he said, looking at the stillness of this queen of the sands, golden like them, white like them, solitary and burning like them. "Well," she said, "I have read your plea in favor of beasts, but how did two so well adapted to understand each other end?" "Ah, well, you see, they ended, as all great passions do end, by a misunderstanding. For some reason one suspects the other of treason. They don't come to an explanation through pride and quarrel and part from sheer obstinacy. Yet sometimes at the best moment a single word or a look is enough. But anyhow, go on with your story. It's horribly difficult, but you will understand after what the old villain told me over his champagne. He said, 'I don't know if I hurt her, but she turned round as if enraged, and with her sharp teeth caught hold of my leg. Gently, I dare say, but I, thinking she would devour me, plunged my dagger into her throat. She rolled over, giving a cry that froze my heart, and I saw her dying, still looking at me without anger. I would have given all the world, my cross even, which I had not got then, to have brought her to life again. It was as though I had murdered a real person, and the soldiers who had seen my flag and were come to my assistance found me in tears. Well, sir," he said, after a moment of silence, "since then I have been in war in Germany, in Spain, in Russia, in France. I have certainly carried my carcass about a good deal. But never have I seen anything like that desert. Ah, yes, it's very beautiful." "What did you feel there?" I asked him. "Oh, that can't be described, young man. Besides, I'm not always regretting my palm trees and my panther. I should have to be very melancholy for that. In the desert, you see, there's everything and nothing." "Yes, but explain." "Well," he said with an impatient gesture, "it is God without mankind." And that's A Passion in the Desert by Honoré de Balzac, from Great Short Stories of the Masters, edited by Charles Nieder. That's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me. If you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio.